Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Morena, kia ora na koutou katoa, kasalelia and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie DeBol, and today on the show, the death of a windsurfer in New Caledonia has sparked the resumption of shark culling.
We should look for the DNA, for the fingerprint of the shark that has just bitten, you know, on the human wounds, something that we don't usually do, but we should do that to have the profile of the offender.
Australia and Samoa signed two new security agreements with a target on drug trafficking.
I know the deep harm to families and communities this causes in Samoa and across the Pacific. And we know to combat drug trafficking, countries need to work together.
And Papua New Guinea's Bilim shines at New York Fashion Week. All that and more shortly, but before we start, I'd like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, also known as Melbourne. Mālo apito. Thank you again for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a provincial government in New Caledonia has announced it will resume culling sharks after a man died in an attack on Sunday. The 55-year-old windsurfer was found dead near the popular beach of Anzvata in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea. The decision to resume culling has prompted concern from environmental groups who say the decision is legally indefensible and politically irresponsible as a New Caledonia court banned shark culls in 2020. Professor Eric Clore, an expert in shark behaviour, told Evan Wasuka indiscriminate shark culling is an ineffective and unscientific strategy for preventing human-shark interactions.
I think that it will not be effective as for the past, you know, culling campaigns, blind culling campaigns were never really effective, you know, to solve the problem of shark attack. So I'm very actually frustrated, you know, because I know very well the place. And I think that New Caledonia is not doing not implementing the right strategy, you know, to face the problem they have. Of course, shark attacks, you know, they are tragedy, but what they are doing, actually, I would say it's useless. It's useless and won't be at all effective. Actually, you know, the shark culling was banned, you know, after a legal decision, you know, but actually, you know, the political people, you know, they just put that back on the table because it seemed that they don't know anything else than, you know, killing sharks when there is such a tragedy, which is a pity, actually.
The provincial government, they're saying they're going to use drumline measures and they'll target sharks as well. What does the science tell us about culling and these methods that the government is employing?
What the science is telling us now, and I have proven it myself, you know, with an example, you know, in the Caribbean where we have been proving what I was saying, which is about having very few sharks capable, you know, to feed on humans. So we call that problem sharks. So if you cull sharks blindly, you will just kill animals that will never have any negative interaction with people. So of course it's a nonsense. I mean, to kill blindly these sharks. What you should do is put in place a different strategy that will allow you, you know, to find these offenders, I would say, because actually there is few attacks, although they are a tragedy, of course, but there is not that many attacks. And most of the time, I would say they are repeat offenses. You know what I mean? So we should look specifically, surgically, I would say, you know, for these problem individuals. For doing that, it's possible. I mean, a new strategy is possible. It would mean that we should look for the DNA, for the fingerprint, doing fingerprinting. We should look for the DNA of the shark that has just bitten, you know, on the human wounds, something that we don't usually do, but we should do that to have the profile of the offender. We wouldn't kill them. We just get, you know, some DNA from the shark. And we could tag the shark. Once you do that, you can, of course, like people that will be dealing, you know, with terrorism, you know, you have your database of reference and you know your potential offenders. And when it happens, then you can identify, you know, the offender. And then you look specifically, you know, for that shark and you remove it. You remove it without culling, you know, all the other sharks.
When the provincial government carried out culling in 2023, there's reports that about 127 sharks were killed in this process. There was a court order that stopped the culling. Now the provincial government has gone against this and it has resumed culling. Are you concerned that the government is acting against a court decision?
Yes, of course. To tell you the truth, I don't even know how they can do that, because there is, you know, an NGO that provoked, you know, that decision of the court, and they tried first, and they gained, you know, the banning of the culling campaign. Then the government tried again, you know, a second time in what we call an appeal, and they lost. So they lost twice, you know. So I don't know how, actually, from a legal point of view, they are daring, you know, to do that again. Time, you know, they are changing. I think that people are less and less ready, you know, to accept that you would kill, you know, blindly animals because they kill a man. Of course, it's a tragedy again. If we were doing the same with people, just imagine you have a serial killer in Sydney or Melbourne, you know, and you send the police in the street and you tell them, okay, every homo sapiens, every human you see, you just kill it. You know what I mean? And like that, we will solve the problem of the serial killer. Of course, people will understand that you will never solve the problem, you know, that way. And unfortunately, that is what we are doing with sharks.
Is there anything the government, the provincial government, can do in the next week or so to deal with this issue?
Well, if they dare or if they want, they can call me and I will be pleased, you know, to support them from a technical and scientific point of view, you know, to implement a more clever, you know, strategy that will, which is not about not killing sharks. But again, I am not about against killing sharks. But what I'm proposing is being as efficient as possible by targeting, you know, the offender and avoid that offender to repeat, you know, any other, you know, attack. I don't know. I'm not hoping that there will be another attack, but actually, I will bet, you know, that it might be the same shark that will attack again if there is another, you know, another attack. And that's why we should target specifically these individuals.
Now, in a press release, the South Province and the City of Noumea said they expressed their profound sadness and deep emotion following the shark attack that claimed the life of a man. Also, in a statement to the ABC, the environmental group Ensemble pour la Planète said it has already initiated legal action, filing an emergency suspension request and a full judicial review on the merits. Now, people on Ambe Island in Vanuatu say activity at the Monaro volcano has increased significantly. The Meteorology and Geohazards Department has also raised its alert from level 2 major unrest to level 3 minor eruption. People close to the volcano have been advised to follow key messages to protect against ashfalls, gas and acid rain. Gibson Tari from the northeast part of the island tells reporter Lea Loanbu he's urging people to remain calm.
I am located in the northeast island of Ambae, and what is happening here in Ambae at the moment, since February 2006, we've noticed that the Monaro volcano started to show up with smoke, plenty roaring noise at night and also in the day, and we also experiencing a lot of glowing at night. And it began during the 25th of February 2006, and the activity started. What's happening during that time is continuing on until today. So people are always there to sit and listen to what we are going to do with this situation, especially with the information coming from the NDM office that the province alert was up, and also from the meteorological department and Chiang Hai Set in Pokhara.
So are there any ashfall in your area?
We don't experience ashfall at this time. We might have ashfall in part of the other part of the island, maybe south or western Bay. But as far as I know, northwest and north, northeast and eastern Bay, we don't have ashfall at the moment.
So have you received any further information from the National Disaster Office in terms of whether this situation will worsen?
People in the communities are expecting to have information from there, especially from the NDMO office from at the Saratamata province of Letpata. But at the moment, we don't receive any information, especially to do away with the activities happening at this time. That's what I can confirm from on behalf of the communities. We don't have any information coming from the authorities from the NDMO office in Panama province.
Okay, so what are some of the very important information that, as a community leader, you're giving out to people in the communities?
People continue to stay calm, especially to relate with these activities. Just to relate from the 2018 activities and what the communities, especially the community leaders, are doing at this time. They work together to make sure everybody is at the safe places, and they advise them to just to sit away, to listen to the authorities, especially with the office of the NDMO at the province of Letkwala, and even the meteorological department and Chiang Hai Set in Pokhara. So we're just sitting and waiting for the information. And it's better information from this as from 2023, February. The communities, especially the leaders, work together, to compromise together to make sure people continue to enjoy the activities, everyday activities as usual, and continue to enjoy what they are doing while waiting for the information coming from the authorities in the at the NDMO office and the meteorological department and the Chiang Hai Set in Pokhara.
Are we expecting that maybe the situation in other parts of Ambai, closer to the volcano, have experienced more of the ashfall?
Actually, we are thinking about the southeast, south and southwest, and west Ambai. Those are the places mostly they will be facing a lot of the, especially with the ashfall. And we believe that those are the closest area that they will be mostly be affected by the ashfall. But from the northwest, as I've said earlier on, northwest, northeast, north, and eastern Bay, we don't experience any ashfall. But what we notice is that probably southeast, south, and southwest, they will be probably experiencing the ashfall as from the 2026 until today.
And that's Gisman Tari, a community leader from Northeast Ambai Island, speaking with reporter Leia Loenbu.
ABC Radio Australia is the trusted voice in the Pacific, connecting our neighbours with news, music, sport and conversations for all ages.
People were thinking maybe these guys were trying to get into the country almost undercover, which would be odd, really.
For many people, this is when the integration truly began.
The parts of the brain that control memory for familiar music seem to be relatively preserved.
The trusted voice in the Pacific. ABC Radio Australia.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whakawelahi, thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat. Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, is in Samoa, where she's signed two new security agreements with the government in Apia. Samoa's Prime Minister, Laulimalia Tor Fossey-Schmidt, says the deals cover the Pacific Policing Initiative, cybercrime response and police training. He says the agreements are about making Samoa and the wider Pacific safer. Penny Wong says they also target the growing threat of international drug trafficking.
I know your Prime Minister, your concern about the scourge of transnational crime, including drug trafficking. And I know the deep harm to families and communities this causes in Samoa and across the Pacific. And we know to combat drug trafficking, countries need to work together. And we understand, our two countries, that working together strengthens the security of Samoa and the whole Pacific family. I saw this firsthand during my visit in 2024 for CHOGM, through the first ever deployment of the Pacific Police Support Group, made possible by the Pacific Policing Initiative, which the Honourable Prime Minister referenced. And that initiative is about stronger coordination, stronger training links across the region, supporting centres of excellence, including in Samoa, and developing a multinational, a regional response capability that is available to Pacific countries when needed.
And that there is Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, speaking in Apia following the signing of two MOUs with the Samoan government. While staying with Samoa, yesterday was the anniversary of a dark period in Samoa's colonial history. On the 24th of February 1928, 400 members of the Mao Independence Movement were arrested by New Zealand's colonial administration in Apia. It preceded what would become known as the Black Saturday Massacre, the next year, when colonial police fired on a peaceful demonstration. Director of Samoan Studies at the National University of Samoa, Tayao Dr. Matawai Tautunu, says the Waimea prison still stands as a reminder of those traumatic days.
That's the prison house built by Germany during the time of colonization. So it is a very emotional and sad history when the Samoan people hang during the colonialism period in that prison. Even when the New Zealand administration came on board, they also used that prison to take the paramount chiefs of Samoa. And that's caused a lot of conflicts during that time. Yes, the New Zealand police arrested people that supported the Mao.
Black Saturday, one of the darkest days in Samoa's history. This is when New Zealand colonial police fired upon a peaceful Mao rally, killing 8 Samoan civilians, including the spiritual leader of Samoa's independence movement, Tupua Tamasese Leolofi III. This took place on the 28th of December in 1929. Could you tell us about Black Saturday?
Yeah, Tupua Tamasese Leolofi IV. So some of the chiefs of Samoa and the supporters of the Mao, they walk all the way from Waimoso to the wharf in the middle of the town to welcome the secretary of the Mao. He just arrived from New Zealand, and then the New Zealand police force, they kill them with their guns. So there are 11 other people are wounded from that event at that day. And we call it that Black Saturday.
And how significant was this event in terms of Samoa's independence struggle?
The significance of that event that started the plan for the independence of Samoa. So when the UN forces came to Samoa and conducted their survey, and they started to recognize the Samoan plan, because Samoa at that time were planning and writing their proposal for self-government. So since that event, I think the New Zealand leaders started hearing the cry of the poor, the cry of the Samoan people to started planning the Samoan request based on these nationalistic movements to consider their voice of having and granting the independence. Without that nationalistic movements, we do not have an independence from the hands of colonial powers. One of the significant part of this event, some of the Samoan Matai titles and the Samoan specific name of places of the some of the villages' name and some of the people's name and some of Matai's name are originated from these special events. So the names of the places, the name of the villages, the name of the Matai names, so that's commemorate these are special events.
You said that some of the titles were named after places during the that were significant during the War for Independence. Could you give an example of the chiefly titles that were named after places?
So one of the chiefly titles named Moe Ilevao. Moe Ilevao literally meaning Samoan language, sleep in the bush. That's one of the titles that explain people slept in the bush because during the Mau movements. And also there is a village in Samoa called Songi. Songi means that is the place where the supporters of the Mau movements and the supporters of the government, they reconciled. So Songi means kiss. That is the place where the supporters of the government and the supporters of the Mau met there and kissed there for peaceful.
And that right there is the Director of Samoan Studies at the National University of Samoa, Taiao Dr. Matavai Tsautsunu, speaking to Whenau Whanua.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We turn now to Guam, where tensions were high last week during a heated public hearing on the island's long-running push for self-determination. At the centre of the storm is a bill that would open a decolonisation plebiscite to all Guam voters rather than native inhabitants only. Previous attempts to limit the vote to the indigenous Chamorro people were struck down by a US federal court, and this new proposal would open the plebiscite to all registered voters, meaning any US citizen who has been a resident on the island for at least 30 days. Now joining me on the line from Washington DC is Dr. Robert Underwood, former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives and is current chair of the Pacific Center for Island Security. With that, I say good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat, Dr. Underwood.
Good morning and good afternoon from Washington, D.C.
Yes, thank you again, Doctor, for joining us. I mean, you were the first to speak at this public hearing, and you strongly opposed this bill. Why was that?
Well, obviously, the whole process of decolonization has to begin with the people who were actually colonized. And, you know, it's really disturbing that people understand the logic of that. And they understand the emotion of that, but they still feel that they have to give in to these so-called constitutionally driven decisions by the U.S. government. And in this instance, as you've characterized it, a person from anywhere who's a U.S. citizen only has to live on Guam 30 days, and then they can participate in a local election. This defies logic. It is unjust, and it's simply wrong-headed.
Yeah, and I can see obviously how this would become very emotionally charged. So because of that, why does this moment then feel particularly significant compared to maybe previous efforts at such a political status vote?
Well, in one sense, we're grateful that the opponents to the to Chamorro self-determination present themselves, because it gives us the opportunity again to remind the community, the island community, and the rest of the world that this is an unresolved issue. At this particular time, the island is undergoing a great deal of militarization, increase in military population. You know, it's anticipated that maybe 5,000 to 10,000 additional military personnel and their dependents could come to Guam over the next 5 years. If that's the case, every single one of them would be eligible to vote in Guam's decolonization. That just is unfair. It's wrongheaded. It's unjust.
Well, Doctor, with the bill itself, it has come about because in 2019, right, the U.S. courts ruled that the Chamorro only voting registry amounted to racial discrimination under the U.S. Constitution. What do you think then of that decision?
Well, obviously, that decision forgot to include the fact that as a political class, the people of Guam who became citizens in 1950 by virtue of a congressional act identified people whose ancestry could be traced back to 1898. And that actually includes some non-Chamorros. So we were trying to adhere to that political definition. And the district court failed to see the logic of that. It's also important to note that Congress has the authority to overcome that by authorizing such a vote. The Guam remains an unincorporated territory, which means that the U.S. Congress can apply or exempt constitutional rights and privileges and application of the Constitution of Guam. So under a kind of a strict scrutiny definition. So there is that possibility. And of course, various advocates on Guam have gone to international bodies and have made their case. But I still think the United States has to hold itself responsible for that, even to begin the conversation on that. You know, New Caledonia, in a way, performs a useful function because at least in that instance, the French government is in active conversation with the local government about how to conduct the plebiscite. In Guam's case, there is no such conversation. They've decided that this is the way it should be held, and there is no further discussion. So I think that the federal government needs to come clean and start talking about this, at least in the same way that France talks to New Caledonia.
But do you think there is still a legally viable pathway for Chamorro self-determination that respects constitutional constraints?
Yes, if the U.S. Congress decides to do so, because the Guam is an unincorporated territory and Congress has plenary authority, and they can decide in this one instance to not apply constitutional constraints. And I think that takes obviously it takes a lot of education and a lot of leadership, but the door is not absolutely closed.
Now, Dr. Guam has been on the United Nations list of non-self-governing territories since 1946. I'd like to know, what has this decolonization struggle looked like over the past 80 years, and why has it been so difficult to resolve?
Well, it's sort of dispiriting. And, you know, the U.S. government has, unfortunately, many leaders of Guam have said that the U.N. has no business in this conversation. An organization I belong to, an OPR, in 1982 made the first presentation to the U.N. I made that presentation. And I think since that time, the people of Guam have been galvanized and trying to and actually use the UN definition of what constitutes a political status resolution, which is statehood, integration, which is statehood in the U.S. system, free association or full independence. So there has been some progress, but of course we have to get over this constitutional impediment.
And just to ask, what are your concerns about if this bill were to pass, Doctor, what is the impact you think it would have on Guam?
Well, it would be destructive of the Chamorro people, because the Chamorro people are not just a cultural entity. They're a political entity as well. And that's that would be the final point. So I remain confident that it will not pass. But it is disturbing that for the first time in Guam's colonial history, someone in the legislature has seen fit to introduce this bill. I think it won't pass. I think this has generated a lot of opposition and in a way has galvanized the self-determination effort again.
Doctor, I understand that there are more public hearings to come. What do you want to see happen moving forward?
I want the sponsor to withdraw the bill. And I've suggested that he should withdraw the bill and engage in real conversations with the people of Guam, the Chamorro people of Guam, to see what they have, what needs to happen. The main sponsor has done some conversations, but I don't believe he fully understands it. It's ironic that this sponsor of this, his father was also a member of the legislature, and his father had testified for Chamorro self-determination in front of the United Nations in the 1990s.
I mean, I do have to quickly ask before we sort of close up, Doctor, are you saying that there has been no real conversation? I mean, how has the public reacted to this situation?
Oh, the public is outraged. The individual, Senator Parkinson, has not had these kinds of conversations with the broader community. So I believe that if he would brought the bill and have a broader conversation, that he would come to understand it and seek alternative ways, including constitutionally sanctioned ways through the U.S. Congress and through federal authority.
Dr. Look, we want to say thank you so much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate your insight into the situation.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you again. That was Dr. Robert Underwood, former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
So we wanted to create a safe space for our Pacifica families to come and learn, share from each other. Mm. First started was mostly boys that were on the spectrum, and now there's quite a few girls that have been diagnosed.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl for Pacific Beat. Quick recap of what's been on the show so far. We shared a story about the death of a windsurfer in New Caledonia that has now sparked the resumption of shark culling. Also, a call for calm in Vanuatu after increased volcanic activity. And Australian Samoa have just recently signed two new security agreements. Still to come, it's all about trade and investment between PNG and Australia, and PNG's Billum shines at New York Fashion Week.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, 30 members of Australia's Papua New Guinea diaspora have travelled to Port Moresby for the inaugural Trade and Investment Delegation. It follows a national survey which sought to capture the diaspora's lived experiences to understand the demographics of the community in Australia and identify the barriers business owners face in terms of trade and partnering with PNG. Lisa Timby, program lead at the PNG Diaspora Business Council of Australia, told Lucy Cooper from the survey, key outcomes have now been discussed with senior PNG government officials.
There was a lot of information, but the key ones, I guess, that we, in terms of policy, could progress in our trip that we went on recently was dual citizenship and barriers to business. I guess the respondents reported a range of constraints affecting business establishment and expansion. Key barriers included access to finance, regulatory complexity, limited business networks, time constraints due to employment and family responsibilities, and challenges navigating compliance or requirements. So if anything, I think what the survey actually showed was that there was actually a need for a consolidated effort to build the capacity of the diaspora here, or, you know, at least have a one-stop shop, like a business center for the diaspora, to build a capacity to not only be contributing citizens to, obviously, to Australia, but also to I guess, implement that people-to-people connection that's actually been said in many of the bilateral agreements.
Dual citizenship was identified in the survey as a leading barrier to economic engagement for diaspora members who have taken Australian citizenship. Why is this?
Good question. There is actually a one or two technical questions in there that actually creates that barrier. And that question is based on... it's a requirement, actually, for dual citizenship to PNG that you need to live in PNG and work in PNG for 5 consecutive years. And in order to, I guess, get dual citizenship, even if you have, you have inheritance from PNG, or you have heritage from PNG, or, you know, there's, you know, we've got some diaspora here who've actually inherited land from PNG, but because they're actually Australian, they can't actually have access to that land legally in PNG. And also, because they're working and living here and they have businesses here in Australia, but they would like to trade with Papua New Guinea and they'd like to do business, have business in PNG and also here in Australia, that clause makes it difficult for them to engage actively in the economy because of that. And so those are a couple of the technical clauses that have been barriers, and we brought that up with the Chief Secretary, Mr. Ivan Pomelio in Papua New Guinea. He had a session with us and we raised some of the concerns that the diaspora had raised in the national survey. And he actually immediately actioned the next day the dual citizenship one. So that's already in motion. And he actually expressed that he didn't know that that was actually an issue or a barrier for the diaspora, because they didn't consider us in the equation when they wrote up all those laws and the policies for governance. But now that we've actually shown ourselves, and there's quite a huge number of us around the world, and it's the biggest, I guess, number in Australia, they do want us to engage.
30 delegates travelled to Port Moresby for the inaugural PNG Australia Diaspora Trade and Investment Delegation this month. How did the PNG government respond to the key outcomes that the group is seeking?
Oh, very positive. If anything, the government saw us as, I guess, children that had been seeded out and were just coming back to sort of give back from whatever we've learned being in Australia or other countries eventually. It was well received. In terms of the outcomes for the PNG Diaspora Trade and Investment Expo, there was actually quite some really good results. So we've got about six agreements, actual business agreements, that are in discussion, and two that have been signed, which I'm very happy. It was a great result from the trip. So it wasn't just a trip to go and network. I mean, it was actually, but at the same time, we were hoping to get traction on actual business deals.
And that there is Lisa Timby, Program Lead at the PNG Diaspora Business Council of Australia. Now to the world of fashion. It was 6 years in the making when Papua New Guinea's Bilim pieces were featured on the runway of the New York Fashion Week. 13 Bilim pieces by Florence Jacques Bilim Mary, with the support women from the Yamban community in Morobe province, were showcased at the international fashion event. The Kauri collection attracted a curious crowd in New York and shone the spotlight on the famous Bilim wear. Florence Jacques told the ABC's Belinda Cora the event was a dream of a lifetime that came along with the responsibility of educating people about the values of Bilim wear.
It's one of the biggest achievements. I think we've been, Bilim Mary has been in the fashion industry since 2002 and then slowly building up until now. That is one of the things. So you need to build a brand. Branding is one of the things that puts you out there. You need to have as much as publicity and marketing strategy in place to make you go out that way. That's one. Number two is, it's just that, I don't know, I just feel like it's time we should take what's ours, what belongs to us in the country, and take it out there and let the world see what we can produce also. Most of the time we see fashion with alpaca, silk, cashmere, and beads, and embroidery, and all those, you know, fashion thing that is going on all around the world. There's nothing that is directly connected to Papua New Guinea.
How were you feeling as soon as these pieces were delivered or entered the runway? What was the, you know, atmosphere like for you and for many who had also supported you on this journey?
As an artist and a designer out there, the first feeling I had was like, oh, we made it. Oh, finally it can come out. It releases all the pressure that has been on my shoulder for the, you know, past couple of weeks in preparation towards launching that on the runway. So it was more like a relief to me. And then, you know, I've been going around showcasing in different runways internationally and both locally. And it's just a normal thing, but taking it to New York has been a dream of a lifetime that me individually I felt that it was something that, like being a Papua New Guinean, taking something out from Papua New Guinea, connecting with other women, bringing the handicrafts, showcasing it. So building the brand was there, then connecting, you know, different weaving communities out on there. So this one specifically was for Finsofen, like the women in Yabin local level government. They were the ones that I've been focusing and working with them through Amunu Foundation. So yeah, when the whole thing came out, the whole Bilum thing came out, like, what more can I say? I just sat there and I was so proud that at least for the first time in history, Bilum has represented Papua New Guinea on the runway. And I'm super proud of that. That's one of the feeling that I had. And after the show, I had to come out, and then, you know, we're always at the backstage. And there I met, I caught up with the organizer, and then he just came, he hugged me, and then he said, name a place. Do you want to go to Los Angeles? You want to go to L.A.? I'm in L.A. You want to go to Milan, Paris? Just name a place. I'm proud. They know where we are now, what we're doing now. So we've secured a spot where Bilum should be.
What was the feedback like in the room, and especially those who were watching?
For the show itself, like, it's a new product again. On a prestigious runway. It's a new product. And when a new product goes on the runway, people do not know what it is. So they're all like sitting down and then opening their mouth like, wow. And the place was like quiet. And they were like trying to work out what it was like. There's a couple of videos that are going around. And if you see through that, you will see the facial expression on many of those people out there, like wherever the camera or the phone makes contact with them, you will notice that people were like, wow. And then, you know, they're taking photos and taking photographs of that. So we are on transit now. So obviously we know we have a lot of, we've got a lot of inquiries and all these, and people want to know our story. People want to know all these things. Many were asking, like, where do you come from? And we say, we're from Papua New Guinea. And they said, oh, Guinea in Africa? And I said, no, we are Papua New Guinea. We are just not of Australia.
What's it been like for the women who actually weave these pieces for you to bring to the runway? How are they feeling right now?
They're out there now. They're all smiling. They're all excited. They're all walking on toes out there. And I've heard what they're doing out there. They're so super excited because, like, it's a village woman in the village doing her product. It's her work that is showcased out on the on a prestigious runway. It's the first of its kind for them, and I know they're super proud of it, and I'm thankful. I'd like to thank them. Whatever they did is already being delivered out to the expectation, to an expectation that none would be thinking about. So, yes, it was delivered today. So thank you to the women out there. The biggest thank you is to Amuni Foundation for making sure that I'm taken care of and looked after very well all the way from Goruka to New York.
And that there is Bilum Mary Florence Jalke speaking there to ABC's Belinda Kaur. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. Provincial government in New Caledonia has announced it will resume culling sharks after a man died in an attack on Sunday. But Eric Clore, an expert in shark behaviour, says indiscriminate shark culling is an ineffective strategy.
I'm very actually frustrated, you know, because I think that New Caledonia is not implementing the right strategy, you know, to face the problem they have. Of course, shark attacks, you know, they are tragedy, but what they are doing, actually, I would say it's useless.
And I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. But remember, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.